Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on the 1st of March, 2020. Looking back at the February just completed, it was a very wet month for this time of year, more like fall levels of precipitation, although we had more snow than we typically see in the fall. It was nice to see the snow accumulating on the mountains, but definitely was not encouraging to get outside in many of those rainy days, with our totals ending up over 13 inches of rain versus an expected of around 6.5 inches for the month. There's been some interesting birds continuing this winter with pine grosbeaks here in more numbers for more extended period of time than I ever remember being aware of before. Also, great-crowned rosy finches, a flock of at least 35, has been seen periodically out at Silver Bay. They're a species that is regularly occurring here high in the mountains during the summer where they nest, but this is the first year I'm aware of them being reported more than just once or twice, and certainly more than one or two birds. So it's interesting opportunity to observe those if you happen to be in Sitka and have some time to walk out between Whale Park and the Industrial Park. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded a couple of days ago with Zach LaPerriere. He's a local Sitkan, a returning guest to the show, and I always appreciate visiting with him about the observations and questions that come up during his explorations outside. I know you like to get out and see things, and we corresponded via email about the tides earlier, and I know you'd mentioned that's something you've been looking at, and I think what prompted me to start paying more attention to the tides was obsession with high tide rather than low tide. I was like, How high does the tide get? I remember, I don't know if it hit Ketchikan in the same way or if you remember in 1984, the big Thanksgiving Day storm.
I do.
That hit here, and that was kind of a... I remember actually driving around town that day with my parents and seeing rocks getting thrown up on the parking lot at Sandy Beach, Nelson Logging Road, well flooded. It was washing out at the end of Arrowhead Trailer Park. They've since put in a riprap reinforcement stuff there, but it didn't used to be out at the end there by the mouth of Indian River. Waves were washing up under there and actually eroding out underneath the trailer on the end. So all of this I remember. And then I remember going hunting after that and seeing debris stuff like water, soap bottle or something that was clearly tide deposited inside the woods. And that was kind of my first experience with high tides. And then as an adult coming back, and I remember going to Stargavin, probably 17 years ago, early 2000s. And the Nelson Logging Road it was a nice day, just a calm day. And I wasn't really paying any particular attention to the tides. It was a high tide. And Nelson Logging Road had a foot and a half of water on it. Now it won't anymore because they've redone the road. But On the old grade there, where they had it, there was a foot and a half of water. And I was just like, okay, well, that must be what the tide is. And, you know, you look in the tide book and you see what the tide's supposed to be. And then you just figure, well, that's what the tide is. But then I got confused because I would go back another time and it was supposed to be the same tide. And it wasn't that high. And I was like, well, what's going on here? So that was kind of my introduction, was just noting where the high tides were. And it sounds like you spent a lot of time on the beach as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I realized the other day that I've pretty much lived on the water for the last 38 years. How lucky is that? But I realized last fall that as much as I thought I was paying attention to the tides as well as the heights, I didn't realize how great they're fluctuating from the predicted tides.
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, 2 feet's not uncommon around here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, most of the time it's fairly close, but, and the only reason I know this, to be clear, is because there's a site that actually, there's a tidal gauge in the channel here. I'm pretty sure it's where it is. And there's a site that has within 10 minutes it's uploaded and, so near real time, here's what the tide's actually doing. And here's what the predicted tide is. So you can actually see, sometimes you can even see it. It changes fast enough. You can see it diverge from predicted and go back as the weather changes. Basically, I think it's mostly pressure, I think.
Totally. Yeah. If you scroll down on that observation, it shows the barometric pressure. Mm. And so, yeah, you'll see that the high pressures make the tides lower and the low pressures make the tides higher.
Yeah. It is surprising. What occurred to me, one of the things that was sort of an insight for me was talking to Hig and Aaron McKittrick, the Journey on the Wild Coast people. They pack rafted from Seattle to out the Alaska Peninsula, and they did a pack raft trip around Cook Inlet, and they've done a number of sort of adventure travel sort of stuff around Alaska. But one of the things they did was travel on the Northwest coast. And I asked them about tides. I was like, did you ever worry about it? And they said, oh, no, like tides there are 9 inches. There's much more effect from atmosphere than there is from tides. And I was like, oh, that gave me some insight as to why they're having trouble in part with erosion up there. Mm-hmm. In addition to the ice not being there as much in the fall. And so then when the storms come in, there's waves. They're built right on the beach because there's no reason not to be. Here, you got to leave enough cushion for those highest fall tides. So you're built well, at the highest tide of the year when the storm comes in. And actually that sort of notorious Thanksgiving Day storm was, I think it was predicted to be 12-foot tide. And it ended up being an extra 2 feet above that. So it ended up being a 14-foot tide, which in the last 15 years that I've been paying attention, I've never seen anything over 14 feet. I've seen a few over 13 feet, but nothing over 14. So that was exceptional. And then things started to wash out a little bit. But, even a 13-foot tide here is not that unusual. And mm-hmm. you would definitely not want to build in a way that put something important below 13 feet. So it's just interesting that we're buffered in some respects. We're buffered from, like, if there's a tsunami, unless it's huge, that unless it hits at a high tide, there's a buffer there of the intertidal that we build just because of the natural, sort of tide variation that happens here. But the low tides, it is interesting, the different patterns of highs and lows. And I don't know, you grew up in Ketchikan, and I know that the tides kind of move around, so they aren't exactly at the same time everywhere at the same time. But here, I guess I kind of always was aware that the lowest tides when we went for Sea Week, for example, in school, they were in the springtime and it was always in the morning. But I didn't really like think of that as a pattern. I was just thinking back, mm-hmm. I recognized, that was mm-hmm. always the case. And so the lowest tides of the year I think of, and I think they are the lowest predicted tides of the year, are generally between May and July. And depends on the year, and I'm sure it has to do with the where the moon happens to be and how close it happens to be relative to where the sun is and all that kind of thing. But basically, they go in the pattern with the moon. And the new moon tides in the summer are the lowest. But I think the full moon ones in the winter, if I remember, it changes a little bit seasonally. Mm-hmm. And in Sitka anyway, those lowest tides are always going to be, that low tide series is always going to be between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m.
Right.
And the lowest ones I think tend to be around 7 or 8 in the morning, the lowest of the sequence, apart from atmospheric effects, the weather can affect that. But then I learned that the reason I didn't know about winter tides is because the low tides happen at night. And so the low winter tides are actually, in this time of year are around 7 o'clock at night and it is dark. And I don't go down to the beach usually at night. So I wasn't aware of that. Although I do remember one time having the opportunity to go for, we went to Sandy Beach to look for sand dollars with lanterns, mm-hmm. When I was a kid one time. And so I didn't, I didn't connect the dots and kind of try and make sense of broader patterns. But thinking back, I reckon, that was a wintertime trip and that's why we went at night. But now I know that Karen Johnson, for example, my son has been doing it. And the Science Center actually had a couple of outings scheduled for the low tide series in the evening. You go out with a headlamp and you can find stuff at the beach at low tide at nighttime. It's obviously a different experience. And the weather can be a little unfortunate. But mm-hmm. sometimes our lowest tide of the year is actually in the wintertime if we have a high pressure system. We were just talking before we started recording that there was a tide earlier this winter. It was within the last month. I think maybe it was in January or early February. And the actual tide ended up being like a -3.6 or a -3.7, which is lower than anything that's ever predicted for here. I think the predicted value was only a -2 or -2.5 or somewhere in there. But there was enough atmospheric pressure downward to really reduce that significantly, which makes, it's surprising sometimes the kind of critters you can find just with that little extra 6 inches of reduction in tide. But you live right on the beach, and I guess you have a chance to kind of observe the comings and goings of the tide pretty regular.
Yeah, there's a reef right out front, which really helps. And so I know that an 11-foot tide, that it disappears. There's another rock that right at a 0-foot tide disappears. So I have pretty good gauges there. And yeah, it started for me in September. I looked out and I knew it was supposed to be an 11-foot tide, and there was almost 2 feet sticking out. And so I was like, what the heck's going on? And I looked online and I saw that it was down 1.5 feet. So it was only a 9.5-foot tide. And then that just opened my eyes. So yeah, tides are cool. I mean, it seems like kids especially get excited about low, low tides. Just there's so many interesting things out there. And I think there's also something to be said if the tide just unexpectedly drops a lot. So like, let's say one day you have a -1.5 and then you get this big high pressure, which we've had a lot of. And then the next day it's like a -3. I think there's a lot of critters that weren't really expecting it as much as if there's the standard buildup. And so they might be a little higher than normal. And so you're seeing things that normally wouldn't be out of the water if they're, you know, if they can move.
Yeah, that's an interesting, I've wondered about that. You know, fish, they say, well, the fishing's better just after the tide change and stuff. And a lot of times that seems like it's out in places where I wouldn't think that there was that much difference with the tide. Mm-hmm. And I'm not much of a fisherman, so I mean, I don't know. But and the intertidal things, and it's like, with intertidal things, I can imagine that they can sense the pressure as it gets deeper and shallower. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if they do or not, but I could imagine that maybe that's part of how they're determining it and having some sense of what the tides are doing. But that has been a source of curiosity for me. It's like, how, I mean, instinctively, I guess it makes sense that they would have evolved or adapted some way of kind of anticipating what the tides are going to be doing, because you don't want to get stranded if you can't breathe in the air, for example. And fish obviously are more mobile than some of the other critters. But yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. Maybe some of the slower moving things like your chitons or whatever might end up getting stuck up high when they could have anticipated it, since they didn't anticipate it being that much lower, and otherwise might have moved out a little bit or at least gone under the rocks.
That's been my experience, and it's by no means conclusive.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what we got, right? So it's like, just get out there and explore and see what happens. And it's interesting. It would be, I'm not the type to set up a study to do that. Probably that's more focused work than I'm. I like to wander a little more than that. But it's those questions that come out of that kind of wandering and just go, that's interesting. And then as you go, you get the chance to see. And that's, you know, another thing about the night. I wonder, in the daylight, you know, there's birds out, and ravens mm-hmm. and crows, among other things, like to get out and gulls. And, you know, I've seen a lot of things eating intertidal critters. So it would make sense that daylight is not a good thing to be out in if you're in an intertidal invertebrate or small fish. But at nighttime, you know, there aren't those aerial predators. There's not the heat and drying of the sun as much. Mm-hmm. So then it makes me wonder if maybe some of them are more active. So, you know, maybe in the end there are a number of things that, granted, my eyesight's a lot worse at night. So there's less stuff. It's less easy mm-hmm. for me to see, but I do have a headlight or a lamp, you know, a flashlight that I could bring. Maybe there are some things that are out that I would struggle to find in the summertime when it's much more pleasant for me. But, you know, obviously maybe less so for them. So they might be hiding better. And I know, yeah, people have found a lot of stuff. Aaron Baldwin used to go out at night and look for some things. And I think some things are actually attracted to lights at night. So some of the swimming critters mm-hmm. in particular, you can get stuff to come up. But so do you do a lot of tide pooling when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I used to live by the tide book. That was probably my favorite thing to do. I didn't identify anything, but I just liked looking around. And low tides are fun, too. I mean, you find a lot of old, what's effectively historical garbage, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
But lots of old bottles and stuff like that. So not that I ever kept any of them, but it just was interesting. So, yeah.
The low tide scavenging, I guess is maybe what I'll call it, that I learned to do was looking for fish hooks during salmon season, especially. Mm-hmm. All the people that lost their fish hooks and go out there at low tide in the morning. And my dad had a whole rack, essentially, of hooks that he'd picked up off the beach. He liked to get up early, so the tides here are conducive for him to get out and see those. I guess in the spring, too, because they're going for Dolly Varden in the spring and then in the fall and the salmon. But you got to get them right away. We'd find old ones every once in a while, and they might not have been more than a year old, I guess, but they were all rusted out. There was not much point in having those. So, but yeah, the tides are, the beaches here are, I was just talking to my son who's looking forward to a trip with his grandparents to Grand Canyon. And he's like, oh, there's so much great stuff down there that I'll get to see. And I was like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff there, but there's also a lot of stuff here. And he's like, well, not really. I was like, have you ever looked at the intertidal? I mean, like, if you want for, because he was saying, well, there's bright colors and there's all these things like beetles. And I said, there's a few of those here, but it's true. There aren't that many. We certainly don't have cactuses. But if you go to the beach intertidal, like it's hard to imagine a more, and in some ways it's just kind of overwhelming because there's so much color and diversity of form and appearance and all those things. But there's a lot of stuff there. And it's just so close. And the thing is at low tide, you know, a lot of it's hunkered down unless you get a nice tide pool. A lot of it's hunkered down and not really even in its fullness. So if you get a chance to, have you ever done any snorkeling?
Very little.
That's where my brother, I've only done very little. I've been out a couple of times and discovered the virtues of a weight belt, which I didn't have. And so it was not a very, it was a very awkward experience. Let's put it that way. It was difficult to actually see stuff that I wanted to see. And there was a bit of surf the day, you know, surge the day I was there. So I was just like a cork in the water, not so great for actually being able to see things. But my brother talked about that, just the different experience of seeing stuff when it's actually doing what it does, instead of just hunkering down in the air, you know, and the sense of space is very different. And so it's one of those things I'd like to do a little bit more of, and just, you know, one of those sort of undiscovered countries that are just right outside our doors, really. And that's what a lot of it around here feels like to me. It's like, you know, it's nice to travel other places and there's plenty of things to see, but I always remind myself, it's like, but even all the little nooks and crannies in the various valleys or bays around here where you get to just go. And it's not like there's a completely new set of things here. It's just the particular arrangement and the way the way that it looks in the fields and the, you know, if there's a little waterfall or a little pond or, and sometimes there's different plants or things there that for me is really motivating and inspiring to get out and explore those. And I know you, it seems like you like to get out and explore on the boat and wander around, I don't know, Southeast Alaska in general, or are you pretty much focused in the Sitka area?
Well, as a kid, my folks and I definitely got out a little wider range, and then all, you know, several trips through BC. But my kids always want to hit the beach. You know, if the engine's been on for half an hour, they ask when we're going to toss the anchor out. So, I mean, it took us a month once to get to Petersburg. So, yeah, we stay pretty close. I mean, and then this last year has been really, really close, more in the skiff than anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's never, I just feel like the more you look, the more you see, and the depth is there. I mean, I think that, you're a great example, Matt, all the different things that you can see just from the road system. I mean, there is no end to that. And boy, it's just amazing.
It is, it's fun to explore and see that. And I'm a little more obsessive about it than most, for sure. But, you know, getting on the trails and getting hiking. And this time of year is actually one of those times where I was just talking with somebody the other day and we were talking about, okay, well, there's a lot of snow on the mountains right now. And neither of us are really into winter mountaineering kind of stuff. I know some people really like the skiing and it's fun to see the tracks up, you know, look with my binoculars up on Verstovia and seeing the tracks up there. And I really like seeing the cornices and the development of the kind of the snow on Bear Mountain and the ripples. I don't know. Can you see Bear Mountain from where you live?
The beach we can.
So the, you know, I don't know how much you just sort of watch that over the course of the winter. In the last few winters, it's been I mean, it's been warmish, but I don't think it's been any warmer than it has been this year. Well, we did have that cold snap, which is the coldest in since 2012, but it's been a lot wetter. I was just looking at there's a website that has the kind of the just the year to date stuff. It has both month and year to date, and we are, I think, already 5 inches above average for this year. So we're almost a month ahead of sort of the mm-hmm. normal. And the last couple of years, we've been well behind normal in the wintertime in terms of total precipitation. The month of February to date was over twice normal. So we had over 12 inches and normal is around 6 inches. Those are just wow. approximate numbers. And you can really see that in the mountains because it hasn't mm-hmm. been so warm. You know, it's been mostly raining at sea level, but snowing from time to time. But even when it's been raining up at Bear Mountain above treeline, you know, it's been snowing. And so just to see the kind of the snow build up there, but it's also so often windy that it gets scoured. And so you get these interesting textures and patterns of the way that the wind is there. I mean, the way that the snow is there. And if I knew more, I probably could interpret, you know, understand what that meant about the winds and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't. So it's just interesting and a curiosity for me. Mm-hmm. And then those big cornices that are forming. And at some point, those must, you know, obviously they're going to fall at some point. It would be interesting to see them fall, I think. But they look, it's hard to say. It's hard to judge scale very well, but they look big.
They're big.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one year in Ketchikan, there was a 30-foot cornice.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then I think it might have been that same year. Everything else melted except for the cornice, and we went up there, and it was still huge.
Wow.
It was really,
so it was that solid that it just was like,
well, it had kind of slumped over a bit. I mean, it was sort of a sad cornice, but at that point, it was still pretty amazing. That was maybe June or July. Yeah. I can't remember just when.
But yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's what the snow does up there is, and they have the sensor up on Harbor Mountain. Mm-hmm. And so you can look at that online as well, but it has not been functional for a little while because apparently they didn't anticipate the amount of snow that was going to be there and the solar panel got buried. So it's not currently broadcasting. I don't know if that data will go in once the solar panel goes and the data is being recorded or if it's all shut down until it gets started again. But at the time that it shut down, it was almost 2 meters of snow. So about 6 feet of snow. Where that was occurring. So I imagine it's deeper up on Bear Mountain and Cross Mountain and those places. But it is, it's interesting still, though, to look at the old photos from 100 years ago, you know, and Cross Mountain is it just looks inflated. It looks like if you had a white skin on it and just kind of like inflated it, it's just puffy with how much snow, especially in the cross itself. There's a picture from the Photoshop from, I think it's like the 1st of June or something in 1939. And it's just like, it's incredible how much more snow there was at that time on the mountain. And I went up Bear Mountain last fall. And I think that may have been the first year that there wasn't like that pretty much all the snow melted. Cause I didn't go up in 2018, but I went up in 2017 and there was still a lot of snow. There's kind of above Beaver Lake, there's a kind of a bowl area there mm-hmm. and some ponds that form in there as things melt. And there was still plenty of snow there in 2017. And in 2018, I had pictures across that showed some snow. Kind of there's that band of cliffs that goes off to the left of the big summit. And there was still snow below that and stuff. So I think there was still some snow in there. But when I was up there in September last year, there was nothing. And so it was really interesting to think that some of that rock may not have been exposed to air for hundreds of years, you know, to daylight, and you could see the glacial striations in it. And so it was also fascinating to me to think about that's not that big of an area, really. I mean, it's big by me as a person, but in terms of thinking about a glacier forming there and having enough mass to actually scrape and make these scratches and scrapes in the rock is it's just interesting to kind of contemplate that and where I was standing and how much snow and ice there would have been over the top of me, you know, when at the peak of the little ice age, say. It's kind of an interesting thing to, I was like those sort of thought experiments about what did things used to be like? And the geologists that I spoke to that were in town last summer, he said you know, people imagine a coming and a going. He said, but the reality is that it's coming and going, you know, in and out all the time. So yeah, there was that ice glacial maximum at the last ice age. But since then, it's retreated in advance and retreated in advance. You know, on average, it's been retreating. But you know, where the average ice, you know, where the glaciers were on average over the past 20,000 years is it's probably further out than we imagine. And so part of what he was looking at was just some of those patterns and how that might have looked. So it gave me a little bit of, I guess, a little bit more to think about. Tell the scientists and the computer modelers are able to generate a picture, you know, a video of the last 20,000 years of ice and snow over Baranof Island and Sitka Sound. I'll have to just stick with my imagination, I guess. So yeah, it's any particular places that you're looking forward to exploring in the coming months as the weather daylight increases and the weather improves?
Oh boy, I just want to get out of town. Yeah, I'd kind of like to spend a little more time up in Peril Strait. Mm-hmm. And then it also feels like things get just that much more exciting after Second Narrows, like start heading down toward Whale Bay. So I don't know. We'll see what the schedule brings.
Yeah. And what kind of, have you, you've spent some time down towards Whale Bay before?
Yeah, both a bit of commercial fishing, just crewing on a troller, which, you know, I don't think I've ever even stepped foot on shore during those periods for obvious reasons. But yeah, we get down there with the family here and there every couple of years. And it's always just, there's just so many cool things, you know, like I think about this little creek that we found a couple winters ago. It seems like it was granite, but I don't think it was. But anyway, it's just this pretty much bare rock creek. And we were there in the winter. Everything was frozen, including the couple of lakes above. And you could just see endless, endless bear trails. And there were still skeletons of fish around. But the whole creek, I don't think it ever was more than about 6 inches deep. And you could see it's just this wide, slow creek that, boy, in the summer, when the fish are running, oh, I wouldn't want to be, you know, within a quarter mile of that unless I was out on the water. I'm sure it is just thick, thick, thick. But so many places like that. So many places you just wandering around. And then all of a sudden, even up in the Alpine, you just start seeing those big old bear tracks that, you know, are several inches into the grass.
Those ancestral trails, I like to call them.
Yeah, that's a good term because they clearly take a while.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, well, the funny thing is that it's clear that they aren't always walking there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how often, because like I think, for example, in a muskeg, where there's some trails like that in a mm-hmm. muskeg, and you think about how quickly muskeg turns to mud when people walk on it, and I don't think it would be much different with bears. In fact, I've seen where bears have hauled in and out of a pond that they go to, and mm-hmm. just the edges of that turn to mud very quickly. It's pretty shallow. And yet those ancestral trails are very intact. So like there's those deeper places where their footprints go, but they aren't muddy typically. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it around there isn't muddy. So yeah, I'm not sure. It's just, it's intriguing to me. You know, how often are they using those? To what extent? You know, it's some sort of signpost, I think, as I understand it, like they're communicating to each mm-hmm. other there. There was one in Deep Inlet, in a muskeg off of Deep Inlet that I saw where there was one, and it led up to a rub tree, and it was mm-hmm. clear that the bears had been rubbing on that tree. And the mosses and the vegetation, as you approached, this was in the winter, so I couldn't tell about all the vegetation, but it looked different than the trail elsewhere. I mean, it looked different than off the trail for sure, but mm-hmm. but even on the trail, it looked different there. And I wondered, I've heard that somebody, I think it was Bob, whose last name I can't remember right now, but worked with the outfit called seaweed.org for a long time.
Oh, Christensen.
Yeah, Christensen, right. And I think it was him that reported seeing a bear on one of those trails, and it was urinating as it was there. Right. So that was part of the... So that made me wonder, well, I mean, that's those are right. obviously nutrients, mm-hmm. so maybe that's influencing what's growing there. Mm-hmm. It's a little inaccessible for me. Like, I don't get out, I don't have a boat, so I don't go out there. So, but I thought, if I could set up a trail cam there and just, like, they maybe only visit that a few times a year. But then just see, you know, is that what's going on there? And then do a more thorough accounting of the vegetation and see if that's influencing it. But yeah, I was curious about it. Those ancestral trails, and then way up high in the mountains, you know, like, and they're long too. They go like an entire ridge. But then you'll see droppings and stuff elsewhere. And so they're clearly not only walking there. But I don't quite understand, what those guys are doing. But I guess that's for bears to know. So it sounds like there was a lot of those trails there on that little creek that...
Yeah. Well, that one was more... There weren't quite...
Or not those kind of trails.
I guess that one made
me
think of it. But yeah, that was just... You could see where there were all sorts of little bedding down spots where they were taking naps and, you know, the prime fishing spots, like every little point or log. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's just... I'm sure it... It must not have smelt good about September.
Oh, no,
between all the dead salmon and the bear poo. But yeah, got to be a fertile one. But here's something interesting, Matt. I have also noticed what you're saying about it being more fertile right around those trails. Like quite often, it seems like there's more cranberries.
Oh.
Or there'll be cranberry plants, but they're fruiting more right next to the trails. So pay attention to that.
Yeah, I'll have to look for that then.
Yeah. I think there's something to that. And that would also maybe explain why the trail's in a little better shape, because there might be more roots and whatnot.
That could be happening. Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to look for that. Last year was good. There were some big cranberries last year. I think probably they liked the sun. They weren't necessarily like the bog cranberries. They weren't like necessarily abundant, but it didn't take as many. to fill up your container. I think my dad was here on a very part-time basis, just out hunting with my son, which mainly means going out for a walk and picking berries and letting my son wander around in the woods more. I think he ended up getting four or five gallons of cranberries last fall, just while he was in the time that he was visiting here to help out my son. And it was good that he was along, because my son needed some help packing some stuff out a couple of times. So, but it was, it was a good year for cranberries. And I'll have to take a look at it wouldn't be that hard I need to remember to do it in the summertime sometime, especially near the sign trees. Cause it seems like, you know, some of those trails are really long, and I don't imagine that they're urinating the whole way, but at least where those sign trees are, it seems like maybe that's a significant place. So, well, and I was also curious, you had been a part of that. I think it was your son that found the charcoal tree and the ash. Have you all been out there since?
We've been out, I think, twice there. Kind of the other side of Shoal Point, roughly. And the first year we were there, I think that might have been the first year it was actually uncovered. Blake found that in September. And then the following year, winter storms had eroded at it. You could still see it. And then I'm thinking we hiked over there. Maybe it wasn't last summer, but the summer before. And you could still see some of it, but
it was
largely eroded.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was wondering. You know, it's that beach over there that's on, I guess it's facing more, is it facing south? Anyway, it's the far beach of Shoals Point. I haven't spent a lot of time over there. I've been over there a couple of times. It gets pretty good sun. The sand temperature at the surface was 130 degrees. I had my little thermometer. I was like, this is really hot sand. And just right at the surface, it was 130 degrees, which was, unpleasant, to stand on, but you know, with any depth, it wasn't that hot. But one thing that I was interested when I was there this last fall, the beach was fairly steep going down to the water, but there was this big kind of bench of sand where it had, and then it rose up to the kind of the headland there or whatever, you know, the upper part where it's actually dune grass and the vegetation is in there. I know that those must just get reshaped every year by storms, and it'll be interesting to see this year, cause we've had quite a few storms, if I get back there next year to see if the beach shape has changed. But the thing that was of particular interest to me, and I hadn't really thought about it, you know, it's just a beach and, you know, there's trees and stuff and it's sand. But I was back. I was walking across to take the shortcut, essentially across overland instead of around the beach, around the point, and was, I don't know, it wasn't like super far back, but it was probably, you know, a good 50 yards off the beach at least, maybe longer. And there was a log there, and I happened to notice that there was a big spike in it. You know, it's like a, I don't know, 6-inch plus spike in it. That, and it occurred to me, I was like, oh, this is probably an old drift log. And the beach is a long way from here right now. And it hadn't occurred to me just how much, I don't know how much of that's due to uplift, some of it, no doubt, but, or how much of it's just due to the sand drifting and then getting settled, mm-hmm. In there. But that, I don't know how old that spike was. You know, I don't know if there's any way to figure out that just based on the style or something, but, it was interesting to me to find that in there and just go, well, that beach has probably changed a lot in 100 years, mm-hmm. Just moving out. And it's, once again, I mean, I should know better by now, but this sense of, oh, the things as I see them are as they have always been, but clearly that's not true. And I know that's not true, but there's this sense of this strange sense of permanence, you know, about the places mm-hmm. that you go. So when you go see something like that's eroded out and you're like, oh, this is probably just recently eroded. And then you go mm-hmm. back, you know, a few years later and it's changed significantly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to think about that that's happening all the time. You know, and each time we go visit a place, it's just a snapshot. Some are more stable than others. And sometimes there's, you know, catastrophic failures like landslides or whatever that radically reshape things. But it is pretty interesting. But you guys did you poke around more and see if there was any other kind of?
Yeah, we looked around more. It's in kind of a brushy, steep spot. So we didn't see anything else, but you know, I'll continue to go back every few years and, yeah. you know, as long as I'm able and look around and maybe another tree will pop up. That one, was identified as a Sitka spruce, which, mm-hmm. Was pretty cool because, my dad and I looked at it and said, oh, looks like spruce, you know, and just having a wood stove and having burnt spruce, you can kind of tell the difference between spruce and other charcoal. But it was still a guess. But you know, maybe there are other species around there.
Yeah.
Jim Bechtel was saying, I think that was almost 14,000 years ago. So apparently there were, Sitka Sound was just a bunch of lakes out there, kind of muskeg ponds, a lot of pine, and then, you know, our standard species. But apparently, have you heard about this, that there was dredging in Sitka Sound or some coring or something like that?
Right.
And they found, old freshwater pond, pollen in that way down. So.
Yeah, the diatoms. I think Tom Ager is the, I think he's retired now, but he was part of that project. I think he did a lot of the coring. Mm-hmm. Did cores in a number of lakes, but they also did coring in Sitka Sound. And it was Sitka Sound where they cored. And I don't remember exactly where that was. I think it was on the south end of the sound somewhere. Like, but inside Bjorka was evidence of a freshwater lake. Mm-hmm. And so a layer of freshwater diatoms, essentially. And that's, you know, there's a whole interesting story there that is still, I think, being worked out. And it would be interesting. I don't know if, I think Jim Bechtel's getting ready to retire soon. But I think Kitty Labounty is hoping to bring him back for another talk, natural history seminar series talk. And if so, I'm not sure what he'll talk about, but I'm hoping to bring him in to talk to him for the show, because I just am curious. It's been several years since I last talked to him, and like, what's the current state of understanding, you know, of the forebulge out there? So like the outer coast would have been much higher, relatively speaking, than it is now. And I don't know what the sort of the bottom is like, if there would still, like if there's a clear low spot that would have been obviously a lake, or if that was a function of the mm-hmm. forebulge being out there, being higher, that created an impoundment and allowed a lake to form. But there's some question as to, it's pretty clear that at Shoals Point, for example, Fred's Creek, that basalt hasn't been overrun by ice. Mm-hmm. What's less clear is how old that basalt is. So there was a couple of geologists here that their primary project was to get some samples from South Baranof, but they had to wait for a weather window. And so I was able to go over with them, and we went to Fred's Creek, and they got some samples of the basalt there, and they're hoping to, I don't know if they'll do it themselves or they were going to share it with somebody else who would hopefully be able to age it and get a better age on it. There has been mm-hmm. some aging work done, but it was done with quite a few years ago with older techniques that aren't necessarily so reliable. But because it isn't clear necessarily how far the ice went out during the last ice age. And if that basalt predates the last ice age, that would suggest that that part of Kruzov wasn't covered during it. But if it's after, then of course, you know, it wouldn't say that at all. So it is an interesting question. And so it is, you know, there's some thought that maybe there was a refugia out there. And if where that tree was found was part of it, or an early kind of area of early retreat, you know, it is, yeah, just all these mysteries of like, what did things look like 20,000 years ago? You know, the mountains probably looked pretty similar, but the lowland terrain and where the water was certainly was pretty different. So yeah, lots of mysteries.
No end of them. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's part of what makes it fun. And I know you this is something, I don't remember if we talked about it last time you were on the show or it was just an email correspondence, but the you mentioned finding worms in your gutter. And right. Maybe you could share a little bit about that and the mystery that currently is.
Well, I have a hard time identifying even a bird past, you know, raven, crow, and kind of the standard one. So I'm not much of an ID person. But yeah, we've lived in the forest just a little outside of Sitka for the last 20 years. And I know other people who actually live in the woods see it too. But we end up every fall getting worms in our gutters. And these are not your standard earthworm type worm. They're skinny and not quite as long. So, you know, 2 to 4 inches tops. And I don't think they're ever more than about 1/8 of an inch around. Somewhat translucent. And they apparently can live underwater, freshwater, for a period of days. So they just start, they'll crawl out of our gutters after a big rain. And our gutters are constantly filling up. We have a bunch of hemlock and cedar trees that hang over the house. So I have to clean our gutters multiple times a year. So these are the things I see when I clean the gutters or when the rain happens. And it's enough to make a person not want to drink rainwater. And I know a friend on Middle Island has seen the same worms. And so the current mystery is, how do they get there? Do they drop out of the trees? Do they grow there? You know, because I see little ones too. I mean, we're talking real little, half an inch or so. So maybe they come from bird droppings and then grow in there. But this is something that, being a carpenter, I've taken a number of gutters apart in other parts of town, and I haven't seen them where there are no trees, but there are just, you know, blown leaves and needles. So a question. I don't know. And I'm sure somebody who can ID them will be able to. I took a little video and I got a sample. I felt a little bad for the little worm, but maybe we can get an ID on that.
Well, you're destroying their home every time you clean your gutters. You might as well just let them fill up, right?
I know. Yeah, it always makes me feel a little bad, but it wouldn't take long. At 1 year and our gutters are overflowing, and then growing little hemlocks and all that. So
it is interesting. The video that you sent me reminded me, you know, there's a lot of different kind of earthworms. There's the big night crawler fat kinds, and there's, I don't really know a lot about it. I'm pretty sure that there's introduced species of earthworms here. I know that there are on the Kenai Peninsula. There's somebody that works for the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge that has done some work on earthworms there, and he's actually said that he's willing to help identify stuff if we send him collections. So that might be a good place to send a collection of those. But there are native earthworms as well, a few. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're all big. I think it, so I don't know that what you're seeing is an earthworm. That would be my best guess based on what I've seen, but definitely not an expert. So I would be happy to be corrected by somebody who knows a lot more than I do. But it was interesting. Like I think at the first time that you mentioned this to me, where do they come from? They might, you know, it's not hard to imagine that once they're in there, then they just kind of are established in there. It's not like you bleach out your gutters every time. So there's probably little nooks and crannies where they can persist and then lay eggs. And I would imagine, like, it's not hard to imagine that for them, that's just another layer of needle duff, you know, like they're happy there mm-hmm. or on the forest floor. Now,
I've never seen them on the forest floor though.
Oh, I've dug around
everywhere.
Interesting.
I've never seen, I mean, there are similar size ones that aren't translucent, that are like fully red and a little fatter.
Interesting.
So, I mean, yeah. I don't know. It's a giant mystery to me.
Yeah. Well, I never thought that worms, you know, you see them on the sidewalk and I just thought, mm-hmm. oh, and it's when it rains and like, oh, they, you know, the received wisdom that I had was that they couldn't be underwater and therefore they, you know, they were getting flooded out essentially. And then they end up on mm-hmm. the sidewalk. And then I was out, Kitty LaBounty was doing some collecting for a project looking at stream invertebrates. It was a comparison project. So there was a number of, I think there was three sites in Sitka area and then some somewhere else. I think both lake and stream. And so I was out and she was doing some collecting and lo and behold, she pulls up a worm. I'm like it's basically there's mm-hmm. a net and you mm-hmm. kind of stomp on the bottom and the stuff drifts into the net and you put it into a tub and then you look through it and you pull out the stuff that you want. But there was an earthworm in there and then I was like, well, that doesn't make sense given my understanding of what earthworms mm-hmm. do. Well, it turns out I did a little reading that earthworms can, in fact, live in the freshwater and they will they will go in freshwater. So they aren't. Yeah, I was wrong, basically. My received wisdom from being a kid was incorrect. I don't know why they show up on the sidewalks, but apparently it isn't necessarily because they're drowning, or at least some species that wouldn't be the case. So that was one thing. So I don't know. But then the other thing, and I think it was a conversation that I had with Richard Nelson at some, and maybe he's the one that told me about it. For some reason, I have it associated, is that worms can actually climb up walls, which I had not, like, that's not what I would think of as a worm being able to do, but they can go up vertical surfaces without too much trouble, I guess, somehow. Maybe it's the little hairs or whatever, and if there's any kind of a grip there. And so it's also at least feasible that they're climbing up your gutter, which seems a little weird, or your walls, but
I think I had to see it, but
yeah, but if they're mostly doing it at night or something, then, mm-hmm. but yeah, I don't know. But if you're not finding them in the dirt, then mm-hmm. it is very, very curious, where things come from. And then, but they're out on Middle Island as well. And so, mm-hmm. lots of mysteries, and maybe we can find somebody that can shed some light on the gutter worm mysteries. Cause I don't think, I mean, I haven't looked that close. I have a pine tree near my house, a large shore pine tree, which and then some spruce. But 99% of the needles, I think, are that pine tree. And I haven't noticed any worms. Now, and I might not have been looking carefully enough. Mostly, I'm just kind of like scoop and toss. But it is, yeah, it's an interesting and intriguing question. And like in that case, it's like you're right in the woods. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be in the woods, or is it enough to just have a few trees around? It sounds like the ones where you've helped out, where it's just kind of blowing in, there's not so much.
Yeah, it seems that way. And then the other crazy thing is Matt and I had this conversation a couple years ago, but I think we had the conversation in the spring. Mm-hmm. And I went and I dug through my gutters and I couldn't find anything. But there had just been a freeze. So maybe they all, you know, head to Florida for the winter. I mean, yeah. I'm just joking. But
the worm equivalent. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's documented that, you know, those kind of creatures are smart enough to, you know, head further down where they're not going to get frozen out if they can. So maybe that's it. I don't know. But I don't see them in the trees. I mean, I've climbed plenty of trees.
Yeah.
I don't see them in the ground. But, you know, the other thing is I spent the better part of 2 months, I ripped our roof off last summer, and there were those, I can't even remember what the bugs were, the sawflies.
Oh,
but there
right.
were so many different things falling out of the trees, you know, spending that much time on the roof, and it changed, you know, depending on the weather, and over the course of those couple of months, it was pretty interesting. And not to mention also all of the sawfly poop. That was just crazy. I mean, apparently it was a lot worse further south. And the trees never showed any signs of stress that I could see. But there were definitely a lot of them up there. And
so those are the conifer, the hemlock conifer sawflies, I think.
I think so.
And they have, the males have these elaborate feathery antennae. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had noticed the frass is what they call it, I guess. Right. I was going up Gavin Hill, and at first I thought they were little, like tiny shoots of mosses that, because they were just little green things that were really small. And but they were all over on the green. I was like, oh, well, they're probably just there. And then people walk on them and so they get killed or whatever. And and then at some point later, I don't remember when, but I realized it was probably from, it was frats from those, from all of those up in the trees. And I think it takes a pretty mighty infestation to do much damage. And it sounds like the last couple of years, they've definitely been a high cycle for those, but they tend to boom and bust, I guess. I don't remember seeing them before the last couple of years, but have seen the larvae, the little, they look like little caterpillars basically. And then, and then adults as well. And learned what they were from posting pictures online and that. But yeah, it's kind of a, it's interesting, you know, even closer to home, you know, we were talking about, well, you don't have to go very far. There's a lot of stuff, but like literally spending 2 months on your roof and you see so many mysteries just all the time. It's like, oh, what's going on here? And, you know, you might have to spend another 6 months to figure it out or 2 years or something.
Right.
Sometimes it's just all that stuff. It's, I just, I constantly have to kind of remind myself that it's easy to imagine that, that there's not that much going on out there. Like, oh, you go out and you don't see much. And so there's not much going on, but there's whole lives, you know, of thousands and probably millions of, certainly millions if we get small enough, creatures that are, you know, leading entire existences and lives without my awareness or knowledge. And when you get out and you look around, you know, whether it's the worms in the gutters or the stuff coming down from the trees, and there's, you know, lots of, you know, this rain of vegetative matter and stuff that's ultimately it's forming that forest floor duff. And it's like, I know this at some level because I go out and I find almost not every time I go out, but often enough, I go out and go like, what's this? I have no idea. And there are things I still, there was, you know, I don't, it was like a little jelly bean in terms of texture. It was more egg shaped. It was more, tapered than a jelly bean, candy jelly bean would, but it, and it was kind of a translucent clear, you know, maybe a half inch on its longest. And it was under an old tarp that, you know, somebody had a campsite up Indian River and they just left a tarp there and we pulled it up and it was there and it looked like an egg of something, but like, it wasn't a slug egg. I don't know what it could have been. Still have yet to figure out. Maybe it was worms, but they seem pretty big. I guess worms can maybe lay eggs that like that. So yeah, so many of those kind of mysteries that are just like, and they're intriguing and they're fascinating and they're motivating. But they're so, it's just so easy to just kind of be complacent and go, oh, well, I've probably seen what there is to see. Probably nothing out there new today. it's funny that pattern, you know, that sort of habit of mind, I guess, really. And the need to kind of remind, although in my case, to be fair, I have accumulated a mountain of sort of photos and observations and mysteries that I don't feel like I've tended very well. And so this winter, especially, I've been, working to kind of bring that under control and get caught up and kind of processing that. And I feel like going out and just accumulating more is just adding to the pile, but like it doesn't, I mean, I guess I get some benefit from it, but if I'm not really doing anything with it, I'm not getting the full benefit and other people aren't getting any benefit from it. So, it does feel a little important to me to try and, process that in a way that makes it more shareable and accessible to folks. otherwise it's just sitting on my computer. So that's my excuse. And I have to say that this rainy month has helped with that project. It's a lot easier to stay inside when it's like, oh, look, there's 3 inches of snow turning to slush as it pours down rain. Good day to stay inside, get some indoor work done. So,
have you ID'd anything interesting?
Well, you know, I have on iNaturalist, which is kind of where I've been. I've gotten through almost all. The only photos I have left, other than from this year, are from 2017, which was our big year project. So I already posted a lot of stuff from that year, but I also took a lot of pictures. And so I need to go through 2017 and just get the pictures in that I didn't post at the time. But up now I've done everything up to 2016 and I've done 2018 and 2019. So I have put in a new species in iNaturalist every month since I started using, not since the very first time I started it, but since I started using it consistently, I think in December of 2015, or maybe it was in 2016. But every month I've had a new species that I've added. You know, it was an old photo perhaps, but I've added. And it's continually interesting that you know, stuff that I didn't know what it was, somebody will come along and identify. And then it's also not just what I'm posting, but for example, Roland Wirth posted a picture of a plant that, well, it looks like it could be Romanzafia unalascensis, which Romanzafia's Sitka mismaiden is the common one. It's a kind of a white flower. It's a pretty little kind of rock plant. You might see it on the gravel bars or in the alpine on kind of moist areas where it's rocky. But there's another species that occurs more west, north and west of here, but has been reported from here, but I've never found it. But on the Stargavin landslide and the gravel bars there, he found one. Last fall, there was Paul Norwood and my son were hiking, and they found a campanula, which is, you know, those bluebell flowers that are on the beaches everywhere. So it's a relative of those, but it's a different species. Hmm. Never seen it even reported on Baranoff Island. They found out one on one of the gravel bars, again, where the landslide had come through. And I'm like, where did that come from? I went up and looked at it, and unfortunately, the flower, within a day, I went the next day, I think, or maybe it was 2 days, and the flower had died back. So but I got enough of the plant to confirm you could tell from the plant that that's what it was. But it just makes me curious, like, where did that come from? Is it growing up in the hills and it just, you know, kind of washed down, or did it blow in or something? But gravel bars are really intriguing because it doesn't take too many years and they're completely taken over by alders. But of course, when they're first formed, they're just barren. But that in between time, you know, stuff comes in and you get this interesting, often there's alpine plants in there that are just in there, but they're only in there for a couple of years. And I didn't really realize this until I was doing some of the survey work in advance of the raising of the dam at Blue Lake. And so we were just surveying the valley and stuff and seeing what was there basically, and making sure there was no rare plants or anything. And so there were some gravel bears there that had this really interesting mix of plants that was like, wow, this is, you know, nothing like super rare or anything, just unusual in occurrence for Baranoff Island, especially out of the alpine. And then went back a couple years later, just before they were finishing up, and it was completely overgrown with alders. And like, wow. I just figured that gravel bar had maybe been maintained or something, but that made me realize, no, it was formed probably in one flood event or something. And it was bare. And then it took a few years for the alders to overtake it. But in the meantime, these other things came in from somewhere. But once the alders were there, I couldn't find the stuff that had been there. They got crowded out, I guess. So yeah, fascinating stuff out there. And, it's just interesting to see what's out there and appreciate your time and sharing some of the things that you've noticed and are curious about. And any other things you want to mention here before we wind down?
Oh, one thing that crossed my mind that I think is pretty interesting about, you mentioned the bear ancestral trails, and I've been paying attention the last few years, you know, when you're over somewhere like Fred's Creek, I don't think exactly Fred's Creek, but south of Fred's Creek, where you'll find a small spruce, you know, maybe 20 feet tall, look underneath there. And I've found quite a few old ancestral trails that have grown over. So, you know, as presumably the beach has come up a little and the trees are there, you know, you just find these old divots that, you know, they're all overgrown now because a bear couldn't get in there. But take a look. Sometimes you have to crawl up under there. I've been accused of being a goof by my family, but I'll often crawl way up and look for them. And it's amazing how often you'll find them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess they probably just move them out towards the shore as the shore creeps outward with uplift and the various processes there. Yeah, we'll have to take a look over that. Well, thanks for coming in.
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks for talking, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded just a couple of days ago with Zach LaPerriere. I want to thank him for taking some time out of his schedule to visit with me, and thank you for listening here this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. You can also find archives of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.